Thanks for joining us on the Ideas Network. I'm Larry Mueller. Our next guest is the author of a new book that looks at the life of Major Taylor and what it was like for a black athlete during the Jim Crow era. Major Taylor broke the color barrier. He became the fastest and most famous bicyclist in the world, as a matter of fact, during the Jim Crow era. And the book, it's called The World's Fastest Man, is absolutely fascinating. It was to me. I bet it will be to you as well if you get a look at it. Michael Cranish is joining us by phone. He's an investigative political reporter for The Washington Post. He's co-authored of the New York Times bestseller Trump Revealed, John Kerry, The Real Romney, and the author of Flight from Monticello, Thomas Jefferson at War. His new book, again, called The World's Fastest Man, The Extraordinary Life of Cyclist Major Taylor, America's First Black Sports Hero. Maybe you're familiar with this bike racing legend. The two guys I just talked with from Two Rivers Bicycle both knew about him. And one of them had read your book already, Michael Cranish. Welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Appreciate it very much. What struck me so much right from the get-go was just the time, that era, which was, 1880 and 90 in that era?
1890s or 1900s, yes. The time of the Jim Crow era, Gilded Age, really a fascinating, important time in our country's history.
It was fascinating to me because of the just the conditions. There weren't automobiles yet.
Right. This is a book. You don't have to care about cycling one whit, hopefully, to enjoy this book.
Right.
I set out to write a book of history of that time in the 1890s, early 1900s, when there was this intersection between racism of the Jim Crow era and the Gilded Age, incredible wealth among an elite. And I wanted to really, sort of draw a portrait of that time and then see it through the eyes of this unparalleled figure in our history, Major Taylor, who we'll talk about. And to set the stage, like you just said, this was before the autos. If you go to the heart of when this story really starts, in the mid-1890s, there were maybe 300 cars in the entire country, and they were basically experiments. They didn't go backwards. Many didn't have brakes. They were typically, put together by bicycle manufacturers. At the same time, there were millions of bicycles. This was the dawn of the bicycle craze. The country had transitioned from the era of the high-wheeled bicycles, very difficult to ride for most people, to the kind of bike we know today with two equal-sized wheels. And very quickly, millions of people across the country, had this sort of liberation that they could go anywhere they wanted to under their own power. There really was nothing like it. You went from the horse and buggy era to, what was considered to be a sleek, modern machine, the bicycle, and many patents of the era were drawn from bicycling at that time and greatly improved this. So that sort of sets the stage. And then you have the terrible racism of the era that Major Taylor has to grow up with.
Yeah, it was fascinating. I just wondered what it must have looked like. And you do a nice job of describing New York City at one point with the streets filled with bicycles.
That's right. I mean, there's this wonderful, I found so many descriptions of bicycling at the time. They were so prominent. And there's one writer very lyrically said that at nighttime, there were so many bicycles on the street that they all had lanterns attached to the front of their bike, like one of your prior guests just mentioned, even today, using a flashing light. But they had so many lanterns attached to these bikes at night that it looked like a river of fire going down the street. The lights just lit up everything that way. So it really gives you an image in your mind about how this was. New York City was the center of the country's bicycling craze, and there were many, many cyclists throughout that city, including Theodore Roosevelt, who started a bicycle corps for the police department when he was police commissioner at the time that Major Taylor was racing in New York City.
You talk about one of the policemen running down a guy getting away in a horse and buggy or something, or trying to get away, and he beat him on his bicycle.
Yeah, hard to believe. I mean, it's like a scene from a movie. That's a little hard to believe. But Theodore Roosevelt described this himself, as I recall it, talking about how this guy could hop up onto his saddle and then use that as propulsion to jump onto the horse rider who was trying to get away. Hard to believe. But, you know, a really fast cyclist on his own power, her own power, could go, I don't know, 25 miles an hour, 30 miles an hour, depending on how good they were. And, you know, most horses, if they weren't going at a fast trot, were not going as fast. So you can see, you know, how that could happen in a burst of speed.
Mike in Greenbush has something for us. Let's go there. Mike, hi. Thank you for calling.
Hi. I heard you on NPR and decided to pick up your book with some curiosity, but it was far greater pleasure than I expected. I just was so amazed at how the history of the bicycle revolutionized transportation, but also the degree of racism that Major Taylor had to put up with. It opened up my eyes to what discrimination there was, and I just thought the photograph of him on his bicycle when he's in his prime, I mean, it's like a sculpture of Van Gogh. I mean, the guy was absolutely it was a great book, great read, and I thank you for writing it.
Oh, Mike, thank you so much. That means so much to me, and that's really the point I was trying to get across, because so many people have said to me after reading the book, it's even worse than I thought. And that's one of the things I wanted to get across. You know, it can be, you know, very difficult to consume all of our history. It's so difficult, tortured, the division. You know, we have divisions today in this country. Go back to the turn of the prior century when we had the Jim Crow laws institutionalizing things. So cut me off if you've got to go to your break. But
no.
The story, you know, the book really begins with this story when Major Taylor is brought by his mentor, a guy named Bertie Munger. They had lived in Indiana, then they moved to Massachusetts. And in 1896, they go to New York City. Major Taylor was rising as an amateur racer. Racing was basically dominated by whites for the most part. There were black racers, to be sure, but the white races were the ones where all the money was, basically. And this white mentor, Bertie Munger, had a manufacturing company, gave Major Taylor a state-of-the-art bicycle, you know, didn't make money off of himself, but really wanted to help him, believed, you know, in civil rights, equal rights, and wanted Major Taylor to be a person who could show that, you know, given the chance, that he could compete against the best riders in the world, no matter what their race. And that race in Madison Square Garden that I refer to happened just 7 months after the infamous Supreme Court ruling of Plessy versus Ferguson, which was the decision that institutionalized racism with the Jim Crow laws. That was the 7-1 decision that said separate but equal, that you could force people to go into a separate railroad car based on the color of their skin. So 7 months later, here's Major Taylor on really the greatest athletic stage in the country at Madison Square Garden. And he competes in what's called the 6-day race, because you go around the track for 6 days straight with an hour rest here or there. And in the book, I tell this story about how there was first a preliminary contest. Few people had heard of Major Taylor. He's allowed to compete because he went to the promoters of this race. And initially, they said, there's no way we're going to let a black person race against the white racers. There'll be a riot in New York City. And one of them said to Major Taylor, shouldn't you be shining the white gentleman's shoes on Fifth Avenue? Well, eventually, Major Taylor was able to convince them that, look, if you let me race, you can promote this as a race of black versus white. It'll create a lot of interest. And the promoters sort of had an epiphany, and this was done again and again, and they did give Taylor a license to compete in this race. They figured he wouldn't last very long. He was about 18 years old. Many racers of much greater experience would drop out after a day or two, and Major Taylor was indeed allowed to compete in this contest that sort of set his career off.
It did indeed. And I want to go back maybe a little bit and talk more about how he came to be, because he had a really interesting life early on, where he almost had like two lives.
He did. His father had fought in the Civil War for the North. He was from Kentucky. He was there at the fall of Richmond. He comes back to Kentucky. They decide to move to Indiana. That's where Major Taylor is born. And growing up, Major Taylor was living with his family. It was a poor family. They did some farming. His father worked for a wealthy person in town, and that person was called a millionaire. I don't know if he actually was a millionaire, but it was a very wealthy white person in the railroad business. And that person had a son, and that son became friends with Marshall Taylor, as he was properly known at the time. So they sort of took Marshall Taylor in, sort of adopted him, not literally, but they brought him in. They basically gave him whatever they gave their son. Their son had a bike. They gave Marshall Taylor a bike. Helped. And so Major Taylor later said it was like being a millionaire's son, being able to stay with his family during certain periods of time and being given a bike. So from a very early time, you know, he had a different upbringing than a lot of people, disadvantaged blacks, would have otherwise had. But he also did experience terrible racism. As he became a better cyclist, which he loved to do, he went to the local YMCA in Indianapolis to train, to use weights and so forth. And he got to the door, and he was told, "You can't come in." Why not? "Because of your skin color. You're black. We don't take blacks in the YMCA." It's shocking to read today, but that was very common at the time. And he was not allowed to go in. And he says the first time that he experienced what he called the monster prejudice. He's a very young kid at this point, maybe he was 10 years old or something, 11 years old. He's very young, and he really hadn't experienced this before. But, you know, he does see that, and there are many people who do try to help him, many people who don't want to help him. So he realizes at this young age what he's up against.
And we will be talking more with our guest today, Michael Cranish. He is the author of The World's Fastest Man, The Extraordinary Life of Cyclist Major Taylor. Certainly, you can join in. I hope you will with your own comments or questions. The number is 1-800-642-1234. Email us at ideas@wpr.org. We're going to take a look at the news, weather, find out what else is in store for us here on the Ideas Network. And then we'll be back with this absolutely extraordinary story of Major Taylor. You stay with us. We'll be back right after the news. Thanks so much for joining us on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here. Well, 50 years before Jackie Robinson, Marshall Major Taylor broke the color barrier to become the fastest and most famous bicyclist in the world. We're talking now with the author of a new book that looks at his life that came about during the Jim Crow era. And to me, it's just a fascinating book, not only about the man, Major Taylor, but about the conditions at that time and what people lived through. The book's title is The World's Fastest Human, and the author is Michael Cranish, with us by phone today. So it's great to have him along, and certainly looking forward to hearing from you. What would you like to know about the beginnings of bicycle racing? Do you enjoy watching competitive biking? Are you familiar with Major Taylor? I hope you'll join in. 1-800-642-1234, or you can email us at ideas@wpr.org. Love to hear from you. By the way, Michael, maybe we you should tell the story of how Marshall Taylor became Major Taylor. Well, that was an interesting little story.
So Marshall Taylor grew up in Indianapolis, and he worked at several bike stores. And he became well-known as a kid. Maybe he was 8, 9, 10 years old, because he was incredible at performing stunts on a bicycle. So to attract customers, he would perform various stunts. And while doing this, he would wear a jacket that was a military-type jacket. It could be this was a jacket that his father had worn when his father fought for the North in the Civil War, or it could have been some kind of a livery, you know, jacket. We just don't know for sure. But what we know is that he wore that type of jacket doing these stunts outside of a store, and someone called him Major Taylor, and that nickname stuck throughout his life, Major Taylor. He did not serve in the military himself, but as I mentioned, you know, his father certainly did. And he became incredibly famous as he began to race professionally. As the book title says, The World's Fastest Man, by the time you go forward, we mentioned 1896 competing in New York City, just a couple of years later, he becomes national champion and then the world champion. This is, like I use the subtitle, America's First Black Sports Hero, long before not just Jackie Robinson, but also before Jesse Owens, who was a sprinter, of course, in the 1930s, and Jack Johnson, who a lot of people think of as the early black sports champion. He was the boxer who won the world champion title in 1908. But Major Taylor was before him. In fact, one of the things I found in the book that people really find interesting is that Jack Johnson himself was a cyclist. He wanted to emulate Major Taylor, who had won the world championship in 1899. So one day, Jack Johnson was cycling in a meet in Texas, and he was seriously injured. It was a very dangerous sport. Major Taylor later said that 11 of his competitors were killed on the track. So Jack Johnson was in this terrible accident. He's in the hospital, and he said it was then he decided he wanted to go into a safer sport, boxing.
Yeah.
So it's hard to believe, but you know, when you look at how incredibly dangerous the sport was, just so you know, people understand, in the 1890s, this was the most popular sport in the country, more so than baseball or boxing. You would have these cathedrals of cycling they called velodromes all over the country, including Wisconsin, of course, and they would draw 10,000-15,000 people to these matches. As Major Taylor became well known, he was often banned because of his race. A lot of racers, white racers, didn't want to ride against him because they knew how good he was, and so they'd claim there was some Jim Crow restriction and so forth. But as I tell in the story, you know, he did find some ways around that, eventually had to leave the country to compete elsewhere. But you know, he did become very successful. Before I forget, I just want to mention, given your audience in Wisconsin, and I didn't put this in the book, but I did do some little research in anticipation of this interview, Larry, and I do see that Major Taylor did compete in Green Bay, Wisconsin in 1898 against some of his very toughest and most racist competitors. So there's a story I found from the Green Bay newspaper of 1898 that talks about how Major Taylor, he wore number 13. Everyone considers that unlucky. Major Taylor considered it his lucky number. So he often wore number 13 on his jersey. He would check into a hotel room that was number 13. He actually had this reverse belief about 13, that he was lucky with that number. And sure enough, in Green Bay, Wisconsin, he competed with number 13. He didn't win the race that I happened to look up in Green Bay, Wisconsin, but there was another race that was, I believe, canceled due to rain. There may have been some other races. When you look in the newspapers of the 1890s, early 1900s, there are thousands of stories about Major Taylor. And what I concluded in my research is that other than, you know, some very well-known black leaders, W.E.B. Du Bois, Booker T. Washington, and so forth, he was one of the most chronicled black men of his day. He became this world sensation because time and again he would beat the best writers and almost always competing against whites because that's where the money was. Those are the most popular races. And he just became so well known, so chronicled. Reporters found him to be a very fascinating story, just like I did, you know, all these years later. And he, you know, gave great interviews. And, you know, he just became this subject of great fascination wherever he went. The big point about Major Taylor that I really think is important to understand, it's not a story about some obscure cyclist of a, you know, another era. What it is, it's a story about, you know, one of the terrible eras in our country's history when blacks were told, you know, basically, you're not equal because we can put you someplace separate. They said it was separate but equal, but that by definition wasn't equal. And there were eugenics theories that were very racist that said blacks were inherently inferior in some way. And Major Taylor set out to disprove this. He knew that there were scientific studies that were done, ironically based on a study of cyclists of his era that the government had conducted to try to determine where do these great cyclists, you know, get their power, their energy, and their endurance from. And basically the study found that they got it from the way they trained, the types of food they ate, you know, things that seem very obvious to us today. Mm-hmm. But at the time of eugenics theories, there were people saying some people are just inherently, you know, better. Major Taylor knew of these studies. He disciplined himself, as your prior caller said, to make basically said, if I'm not in perfect condition, if I'm an ounce over or underweight, then he loses his competitive edge. He was incredibly well-honed, well-trained. He ate, you know, a diet that we would consider today ideal. At the time, few people were following such dietary restrictions. He consumed mass quantities of eggs to get his protein and so forth. And you look at the photo of him when he's a scrawny 15-year-old, and then just a few years later, at the peak of his form, and that these photos are in the book, it's really extraordinary. He had to have been one of the fittest athletes in the world of his time. And that's how, even though he was just 5'7", 150 or so pounds when he was competing, sprinters typically were much bigger, athletes. But he was able to do this by being what he called, I have to be in perfect condition. That was his words. And he included this photo of himself showing himself just in shorts, you know, bulging with muscles, just incredibly fit, because that's what he needed to do in order to win.
Yeah, fascinating. Conrad in Ashland, we'll give you a chance now. Hi, Conrad.
Hi. I was just wondering, are there still velodromes around? I mean, I never see any bicycle racing on TV or anything. I'd certainly watch if there was.
Oh.
Well, it's a good question. There are some velodromes still in this country. In fact, if you go to Indianapolis, where Major Taylor grew up, there is a velodrome called the Major Taylor Velodrome, where they have races. There is a velodrome, it's probably one of the better known in the country, in Pennsylvania, that a lot of people go to. You're right. I mean, the sport is nothing like it used to be. If you look at the newspapers back in the time of Taylor's day, there were oftentimes three or four velodromes in a lot of cities, and in the largest cities, even more than that. You could, you know, I don't know where the caller is calling from, but you can go to the major cities in Wisconsin, and no doubt there were velodromes there. I don't know how large they were, but I just referenced the races that were held in Green Bay. So, you know, they were all over. It was very common. It was such a popular sport. This was the new era. This was before automobiles. So when you're transitioning from the horse and buggy era to the bicycle era, and they often would ride behind pacers. So initially this was two or three or even five men on one bicycle contraption. They called them quintiles. You'd have five men on a bike. That bike could go incredibly fast. And then the single racers would go behind that and be paced by it. Eventually that was replaced by a motorcycle type of device. Before what we know today, it was a motorcycle. It was basically a double, basically a tandem bike with a motor attached to it. And they could go in speeds exceeding 40 miles an hour. So that was very, very fast before the age of the automobile. Trains could go faster, but that was about it. People had not seen a human being under his or her own power going that fast. So, you know, this was very exciting. Of course, it became eclipsed by auto racing. So when you see the auto racing tracks of today, they're built in the same principle as the velodromes. There are these oval banked tracks. So in some cases, they actually used the bicycle velodromes. In the case of Indianapolis, one of the initial velodromes was built by Carl Fisher, who later built the Indy 500 track with some others. So there's a very clear line in the sporting history.
And I think, Conrad, if you when the Olympics come up next, you there's bicycle racing in the Olympics, and it's kind of similar to the kind of racing that Major Taylor did, if I'm not mistaken, Michael.
That's right. There is track racing there. They also have longer distance racing. So, you know, there's the Tour de France that people know of today, things like that. That's a couple of thousand miles over 3 weeks. I referenced earlier the race at Madison Square Garden, the six-day race. Major Taylor, in that contest, there was a preliminary match where he actually beat in the field. He won that preliminary match, his first real professional race. So he won the half-mile sprint in that match that I tell about in detail in the book. And then in the six-day race, he stayed in till the end. I tell this story in detail because it's one of the most extraordinary races of the time. But the bottom line is that six-day race was about 1,700 miles in 6 days. The Tour de France is about maybe, I don't know, 2,100 miles over 3 weeks.
Yeah.
So just put that in perspective. Major Taylor, to compete in this race as an 18-year-old, he'd never done anything like this. He really had no business competing in that kind of race after the kind of shorter races he basically had trained for. But incredibly, somehow he managed to survive. Many more experienced racers dropped out after a few days. But it was very difficult. His trainer would tell him, okay, you can take an hour break. 15 minutes later, he said, okay, the hour's up. Put him back on the track. It was so difficult for Major Taylor. After 3 days, he was hallucinating. At one point, he said, "There's a man chasing me on the track with a knife." This was very difficult condition. Madison Square Garden, I found many, many, many stories, because this was such a publicized event, in the press from that era. And putting them all together, you can really see the difficult conditions that he was racing under. He said you could barely see around the track. There was so much smoke from tobacco or the grease from the making sausages or whatever. And he said some of his white riders were so covered in grease and grime and smoke that they could have passed for his brothers. So yeah. You can just imagine how difficult it was to race in those conditions.
A listener called in, by the way, from Kenosha, Wisconsin, to say that Kenosha has a beautiful velodrome. So
today.
There you go.
Oh.
So there you go.
Okay.
You know, not only the danger of riding on a track like that, also you had guys like Eddie Bald who were I think one of his major competitors.
Correct.
Who were very racist and did everything they could to run him off the track and everything else.
Eddie Bald, I'll tell you that story briefly. And in fact, he's one of the persons who raced against Taylor in Green Bay that I referenced earlier. So quite interesting. Eddie Bald was known as Eddie Cannonball Bald because he could shoot like a ball from a cannon to win a race. He was considered the best sprinter in the country. So in the preliminary match I referenced at Madison Square Garden, Eddie Bald was widely expected to win. That was his specialty. He was a very tall, handsome individual, looked like a star of Broadway, which he hoped he could be, in fact. He was earning $10,000 a year at a time that the average income was maybe $300 a year, and much less for black Americans. His picture was on the cover of all sorts of products. He was a superstar before that phrase was coined. So he raced against Major Taylor in that preliminary half-mile race, and the crowd was astonished as Major Taylor was able to actually beat Eddie Bald in that contest. It really set Major Taylor off on his path to superstardom by beating Eddie Bald, and they became bitter, bitter rivals over the course of a number of years. Bald ran a cycling organization that basically tried to ban Taylor. So they faced off again and again and again, including in Green Bay.
And Major Taylor actually wound up spending a lot of time in Europe, especially France.
That's correct. So go ahead.
No, I mean, part of it had to do, I think, with the kind of treatment he got here.
That's correct. So by 1899, Major Taylor had basically won a national championship here, but there were a lot of racers trying to stop him from competing. He was able to compete in the world championship that was being held in Montreal in August of 1899. Some of his white competitors from this country refused to go there because they didn't want to be in the same track with Major Taylor. But a lot of other riders did, and a lot of the best riders from the world did compete there. And Major Taylor did win the world championship in Montreal. When he competed in this country, they often would play racist songs like Dixie or Down on Suwannee River or things like that, or titles I don't want to repeat on the air. But when he won the world championship in Montreal, they played the Star Spangled Banner. And Major Taylor later said, "I never felt more American than when I heard the Star Spangled Banner played for me in Montreal." It's a very moving statement that really puts in perspective the conditions he faced. It was really difficult for him to race in the United States after that. Promoters in France, which was the center of the cycling world, really, they came to his home in Worcester, Massachusetts, and implored him to race there. Major Taylor wouldn't do it initially because that would require him to race on Sundays. He had promised his mother, for religious reasons, he would never do that. After a couple of years, they eventually came back and said, "Look, we give in. There's no racer we want to race in Paris other than Major Taylor." So Major Taylor did agree on the condition he didn't have to race Sundays. They paid him a lot of money, and he went over there, and he competed against the best racer in France. And this, in some ways, is my favorite part of the book, because you see he is so honored when he comes into France. You know, it's such a center of the cycling world. They appreciate his talent. He's one of the few black men people see in the streets of Paris, and he became very well known. There are stories from the Paris press that say, you know, everyone knew who Major Taylor was when he walked the streets, and he really became a sensation. And I tell in great detail Paris of the time. So it was one of the great pleasures for me to go there and really describe, and there's a chapter called A Black Man in Paris, for example. And you see Paris of the 1901 through the eyes of Major Taylor, because he wrote stories about his experience there for the French press, for magazines and newspapers. So Major Taylor did write an autobiography, but the best descriptions are the very effusive coverage that was done by the French press, and then Taylor's own articles that he wrote for the French press, where he describes what he sees. There's the photography of the era had greatly improved. You can see he was given treatment, staying at the best hotels, which oftentimes in this country he was denied service at hotels. Over there, he was put up and treated, you know, like royalty, which he basically was. In the cycling world, there's a wonderful picture of him in one hotel where he's playing the piano and also playing the mandolin. This was a man of many, many talents. Very refined gentleman, had to educate himself because he was denied education for racist reasons. But you really get a sense, I hope, of the world at that time and the contrast between what was going on, Jim Crow in the United States, and then what was going on in Paris. And he later won championships throughout Europe and then for two seasons in Australia. So he found he was much better welcomed at that period of time abroad, as a number of Black Americans did. So he really that just fascinated me no end. What, you know, the contrast between what happened here and what happened overseas.
Yeah, it was amazing to me as well. And he married and had a child.
He did. He married a woman named Daisy. And then when they were in Sydney, Australia, when Major Taylor was competing there, their child was born, and they named her after the city in Australia, Sydney. S-Y-D-N-E-Y. And I'm very happy to say that 96 years later, I had the chance to meet Sydney. She was living in a care facility in Pittsburgh. This was in 2001. I was working as a reporter for the Boston Globe. And I had the idea of writing a magazine story about Major Taylor because he had lived in Massachusetts for much of his life. So after I got that, you know, onto that idea, I learned that Sydney Taylor was still living, 96 years old in Pittsburgh, and I went out to see her. And she told me, you know, about her father's life. She recalled sitting in the stands as her father raced in Paris, cheering him on. So that, and I also got a chance to meet at that time one of Taylor's great-grandchildren. And I've had a chance to meet many of the Taylor family members since then. But obviously meeting his daughter, who had seen her father race, that's an experience that really animated me, and her voice has been in my ear, you know, ever since, and certainly as I wrote the book.
Yeah, it is a fascinating, just to be able, it must have been just fantastic to be able to talk with her after all of the work you've done on this and research in the book.
Well, it's a project that when I wrote the magazine story that appeared the weekend after 9/11, and I had a lot of people write at that time before email, really, a lot of people write me letters at the time saying that we needed a story like this at this time, very inspirational. And so at that time, I thought maybe there's a book here. I'd never written a book at that time. So I started thinking about maybe writing a book. In the interim, I wrote other books. but over time, I collected information. More newspapers were digitized. And a lot of new material came to me as a result of that over the years. And so eventually I wrote bits and pieces, and then I really bore down and got serious a couple of years ago to finish it. So it's called The World's Fastest Man, but as I tell people, it was not the world's fastest book.
On that note, Michael, I just wanted to say I so much enjoyed your book. I want to thank you so much for taking time to be with us today. We've covered a lot, but we certainly haven't. You need to pick the book up to really understand the his life and life during that era. Thank you so much for being with us and for writing the book.
Thanks so much for having me. It's really been an honor. Thank you.
Michael Cranish, our guest today. His book is titled The World's Fastest Man, subtitled The Extraordinary Life of a Cyclist, Major Taylor. And I can highly recommend it to you. I really enjoyed reading it. And Jill Nadeau read it too, and she loved it as well. And the Kenosha Visitors Bureau tells me that track has been in Kenosha, that velodrome has been renovated and in operation. Thank you so much for listening today, and please stay with us. Lots more in store here on the Ideas Network. I'm Larry Mueller.